This is the Freshman 15.
This is Daniel Long, and you haven't heard from me for a while because I've actually been on the run with my girl after robbing a few toy stores.
And this is Jeremy Bear, and Daniel just stole my intro.
What can I say?
You've said it all, Daniel, and right. You think I'm kidding. You stole my intro, dude. I had a whole thing planned to say about being on the run with my best girl from Johnny Law.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
That's true.
It's too easy.
Season 2.
We're back at it.
Back at it. It's been quite a while, and I do want to say that, not by way of an apology, because we needed the time
right,
off.
Right, we did.
But I've missed it.
I've missed it so much. We had some crazy months in there.
I think that was part of the reason why we had to take such a long break, is because, you know, we had nasty schedules and all that. But those of you that are listening right now have missed us also, and for that, I am very grateful.
But here's the thing that we have been doing. I mean, I've been doing it. We've been making lists.
Yeah.
For this round two, people we have to get in here.
Yeah. I mean, we were so dissatisfied when we got to the end of our 15 names, 15 directors to talk about. And of course, by the way, if this is your jumping on point, you should know that here at the Freshman 15, this podcast is all about discussing the freshman film, which is to say the very first film of in each episode, a different director. And there's so many great directors to talk about. And there's also so many not great directors to talk about.
Right.
There's so many interesting subjects and freshman films to get into that it was going to just be an impossibility to limit our podcast to 15 episodes. It wasn't going to happen.
Volume 1. We threw in names. We said, no, not maybe not that one right now. And so there were some names we wanted to get to that we just didn't get to.
We did a top 10.
Right.
And you probably, and if you paid attention to that, it probably wasn't lost on you that after following that top 10, we started doing quite a few picks from Daniel. Because, and by the way, I want this to be clear that the reason that we've done, and as you're about to find out, are continuing to do so many picks from Daniel's part of that list is because I was excited and inflamed by all the different picks that Daniel discussed. Ooh. Because I was like, I need to go and revisit these films because it's just the way you Daniel talked about the films and the things that you brought to light about why you love them so much. I'm like, oh well, I've got to go watch Gates of Heaven, and you know, now I've got to go see this, and now I've got to go see that, and you know, and today's film is no exception. Hearing you talk about today's director was part of the reason that I just felt like we got to do another season.
Oh man, that's exciting. And I'm grateful that you said that you were inflamed.
Yeah.
I feel like that's high praise. It's a great image. That's actually one of my favorite, even though it was a special, it was one of my favorite times.
Yeah, me too.
And to hear each other just talk about the films that we love and why we love them.
Can I make a confession?
Do it.
And this is something that I meant to do for so many past episodes, but I've neglected to do it each time. It was called to my attention shortly after that special that I made a mistake.
But that doesn't happen.
No, it happened, man. It happened. And I want to name it right now, and I want to say thank you to the person who called me out on it. His name is Steve Judy.
Oh, this is... Okay, Steve, I remember this.
I declared... I can't remember where I put it on the list. It was around number 7, something like that. I declared my 7th favorite freshman film in that list was Swingers by Doug Liman, which is a film I'll always love. And I don't regret recommending it. However, it was pointed out to me that technically that was not Doug Liman's freshman film.
Which is surprising.
It was a sophomore film, actually. And
what was his freshman film?
Doug Liman's freshman film was actually a 1994 film called Getting In. I have not seen this film. According to IMDb, it's a comedy romance thriller. It's Doug Liman. I'm sure it's great. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Swingers was not a freshman film. So much apologies to the legendary Doug Liman. Apologies to the audience. You deserve more integrity than I showed during this top 10 list. If you want to, you know, sub in the freshman film of your choice.
Ooh, for that. That's a good one for number 7.
Yeah, it's a choose your own adventure.
Oh, I love it.
You know what, Daniel? We could talk about the podcast and we could talk about how much we love films in general and different directors. But we all know that eventually people are here for this volume two to hear about a very specific director, a very specific film in question. And I don't know, man. I think it's time to actually just get into it.
We just go for it?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
What's your name? I said mine.
Holly.
Well, listen, Holly. You, I don't know, want to take a walk with me?
What for?
Oh, I got some stuff to say. Guess I'm kind of lucky that way. Most people don't have anything on their minds, do they? Oh, incidentally, my last name is Carruthers. Sounds a little too much like your others, huh?
It's okay.
Yeah, well, nobody asked me what I thought. They just hung it on me.
So as narcissistic as it sounds, I've in preparation for getting back into the groove of doing this podcast, I've been listening to recent podcast episodes.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you have to. I've been doing the same thing.
Even this morning, I was listening to our episode, I want to say maybe 11, 10 or 11, something like that. Whatever the case, it was our Paul Thomas Anderson episode.
Right.
And I was struck by one of the observations that we were making about Paul Thomas Anderson in general, which was that he's the type of artist to give you just enough to intrigue you without sort of overly explaining. And I think that that is almost maybe the defining characteristic of today's director in question. And the director, of course, is Terrence Malick and his freshman film,
Badlands.
That's right.
So Badlands was on my top 10.
It's a great pick. Maybe before we completely get into the discussion, for those who haven't seen, maybe a quick premise for Badlands.
Okay, quick premise for Badlands. So the film takes place in South Dakota, and it follows Kit Carruthers and Holly, Kit played by Martin Sheen, Holly played by Sissy Spacek, and really these are two people who fall in love and are on the run because they are honestly on a killing spree.
Right.
It's a fascinating premise, but and as I'm saying it, I'm realizing that people who haven't seen it might have an idea in their mind of what this film would be like, but it's anything other than what you would think this storyline would be.
I think what we briefly talked about, True Romance, was this same sort of thing, and Tarantino wrote at least a couple of different films about, you know, what's the idea, you know, these in love and on the run and, you know, killing your way across America and that kind of thing. And I think when you look at some of these movies, and they were really popular in the 90s, that theme, I think all of them owe something to Badlands. This wasn't really something that people were writing stories and making movies about. And the fact that Terrence Malick saw that story and saw something inside that story and said, I'm not just going to take something and like a story like this, which, by the way, wasn't completely and wholly based on a true story, but kind of. We'll talk about that in a minute, but he sort of found an angle into it that was not necessarily the high drama, high thriller intensity or anything like that, but he found this sort of moody human undergirding intensity that he built the whole house out of. And that's something that we still haven't really, I think, fully recaptured in any movie that you would say is supposedly along these lines. And I think maybe part of the reason is kind of amping up the drama and tension in a story like that is almost the easy thing to do. But that's what's so intriguing about Badlands, to me anyway. He actually went the other way and actually sort of mellowed the whole thing out, which I just don't know that there's another director that would do that.
Right. And it's not sensationalized, right? The violence and everything that's kind of going on that really propels the story forward. All those things happen so quickly.
Yeah.
And the story isn't about that. I'm curious, so when was the first time that you saw Badlands?
Okay, so this is a little bit of a confession, because I think even when we were talking about it on the list episode, I mentioned that I hadn't really paid the attention that I think it was due over the years. I realized shortly after that episode, I went back to it, and I realized that I don't think that I had actually seen all of it beginning to end. And so I watched it. And so at this point, this is, you know, several months ago, but I think it was actually several months ago that was my first full focused viewing of Badlands.
Really?
Yeah. And it was something that I think I just sort of always assumed that I had fully seen, but in that full viewing, I was like, no, there's some of this stuff that isn't even familiar to me. So it's actually been in the last year, the first time that I fully sat down and took in Badlands. I got to tell you, I was so blown away. It was immediately, I was a half hour into the movie, and it was already just one of the greatest pieces of art that I had seen in a long, long time.
Wow, that's fun to hear.
Incredible film. And it's just, and again, it made me grateful for the recommendation. But what about you? Now, you're a Terrence Malick guy.
I am, but I feel like and we can talk about this later, but I kind of want to qualify being a Terrence Malick guy considering his more recent films, but we'll talk about that later. So I first saw Badlands in college, and so the first Terrence Malick film I saw was Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
And then I kind of made my way backwards chronologically from that point. Right. And he'd only had three films at that point. So I'd seen Thin Red Line, and then there's only Days of Heaven before that, and then Badlands before that. So and I watched them pretty close together after having seen Thin Red Line. But what's interesting watching it in that order is I still didn't expect what I saw, because it actually is so different than, it's so different than anything that comes after it.
Yeah.
It was such a wonderful experience. You have this thing going on when you're watching Badlands where you think the point of the story is to find some sense of clarity or understanding.
Yeah.
As to motive, I guess is the best way of saying it. It's to why Kit is killing people.
Right.
And why Holly stays with him. It doesn't give it to you, at least in the sense of, oh, here's all that's happened to Kit. Here's kind of what's going on in society at the time. You don't get that. You actually get, it chronicles this experience. And as a viewer, you are left to wonder, what am I to do with this?
Right.
Like the point you were making with Paul Thomas Anderson, we are to make something of it.
Yeah. The movies, we become filmmakers, right, when we watch it. And that's something that's really, really intriguing. And I'll go so far as to say that if you look at some of Malick's recent work compared to Badlands or Days of Heaven, I mean, you're going to see this profound evolution. I mean, it's not even readily apparent that this is the same guy.
Right.
Now, you mentioned, like, you know, Thin Red Line was actually his third film. This is another recent epiphany for me. I kind of just always thought that there was this huge library of Malick films that I just was unaware of, that I just hadn't seen. But then when I dug into it, I was like, oh, no, he just took like a 20-year break.
Yeah.
And that's what was so astonishing. In between Days of Heaven is his sophomore film and Thin Red Line, his third film. I mean, that was 20 years in between. Such a stylistic evolution in that time. It was clearly a defining couple of decades, because he completely revamped his style. Now, I say all that, but there are things, though, I think that he hung on to. And I think that's one of them, which is this almost this phobic approach to the idea of closure. You know, just he doesn't want to facilitate any sort of resolution or anything like that in the mind of his audience. He can't, and I don't want to say he can't handle it, but he clearly wants to just leave that for other artists. He wants you to be in the moment with the characters, not trying to figure out a lesson or any kind of a wrap up or anything like that. He says, no, I'm not going to give you that. In fact, if you're looking forward to that, you're not in this movie with me.
No. Yeah. And I think that's one of his fundamental convictions, right? As a filmmaker, maybe even as a human being, is that life is something to be pondered, not to be concluded or to be closed down into one statement of clarity or purpose. But because if that's the case, then you're actually missing the whole point of what it means to be a human being, what it means to live, which is to consider all of these different things.
Right.
I think that's a fascinating break between Days of Heaven and Thin Red Line, because I think what he ended up doing was he went over to Europe and he taught philosophy.
Mm. I didn't know that.
Which, I mean, thinking about, oh, I'm going to make these two great films, Badlands and Days of Heaven, which are just stylistically amazing.
Sure.
And then just kind of take a break and to pursue a different form of maybe exploring the same thing, which is just thinking about life and all of these big ideas. He presents us with art that I think is fascinating for that reason. And I'd say frustrating for some who, that's not their main approach to cinema is, yeah, I just want to think about something. No, at the end of it, they want to have something given, received. Oh, okay, that's what I'm supposed to get. That's good. And not that that's bad. I think that there are great films that do that, but he's just not willing to.
I think one of the things that you see in every Terrence Malick film, now I want to qualify this. I haven't seen every Terrence Malick film. There's a couple that I haven't caught specifically. I've not seen his most recent one.
Song to Song.
Song to Song.
I haven't seen it either.
To the Wonder is one I have also not caught.
Okay.
And I've seen a good chunk of The New World, but not all of it. Something, though, that's clearly consistent in every film is he loves shooting these amazing vistas
Right.
seem to go on forever. He's a guy that's clearly the most comfortable outdoors, for one thing,
yeah.
which is also very interesting for a filmmaker because, you know, and I say this as someone who shoots a lot of material mm-hmm. because it's part of my job. Indoors is easier. It's safer. It's more controlled. It's you have more options in terms of lighting and composition, and you can control that. You go outside, it all sort of goes out the window. But Malick says, unless I absolutely positively have to be indoors to do a scene, he's going to go outside. Forget it.
That's true.
The only scenes that he has in any of his movies that are shot indoors, it's almost like begrudgingly, like sort of done, like, okay, well, I guess this doesn't make sense if it's not inside, so we'll do it here. But he loves the outdoors, not just the outdoors. He loves these wide angle, almost infinite horizon sorts of mm-hmm. shots that linger. I read an article that mentioned that he has a really specific approach to color correction.
Oh. And
I think it was something that you can see even as far back as Badlands, which is to say, especially now, it's in vogue. And it has been for decades for directors to decide, okay, is this a warm scene? Is this a cool scene? Is this a, you know, is this, where does the warm butt up against the cool and all that? And Terrence Malick very intentionally avoids all that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think he may have even said, I don't know if this is in an interview or something, but he said, if I'm bending color temperature, that's not really authentic. I want to get everything that's as saturated or unsaturated as it really is. I want you to be hit with the real thing. If you don't feel like you're being hit with the real thing color wise, then I'm not doing my job. I think he has this thing where he feels like he needs you to be authentically in the moment, mm-hmm. which is much different than being authentically in the scene or in the story. He would much rather you're in the moment, particularly in his recent work. Even down to color temperature, that's something. Now, I mentioned the wide angle thing. To me, that's something that he's doing, not just intentionally with the horizons that he's shooting and all this kind of stuff, but even his characters. He does a thing, and he was doing it in even as far back as Badlands, but even much more dramatically in recent decades. He continues to use these lenses, these wide angle lenses, that sort of bend the world around your view in such a way that he even includes characters in that. Now, what that does when he's shooting like a scene that might be, say, like a conversation or something like that, this isn't quite as present in Badlands, mm-hmm. but you can see it definitely is more recent work because of that almost fisheye quality to what's going on inside the lens. A movement of a character that's near the lens of 3 inches feels like half a mile.
Really?
Yeah. So if you see someone just barely lean in or something like that, it feels like a god looming over you almost or something. And then when they pull back just barely, then again, it just seems just like it feels like they've flown off into the distance or something. So it's this big sweeping, you know, even as I say, he wants the naturalism of color temperature. In contrast, he wants the stylization of just, I don't know, epic gestures and those sorts of things. And that juxtaposition to me is so intriguing.
That's fascinating because I'm thinking of specific scenes in Tree of Life, in particular with Brad Pitt's character as the father. Some of those movements, I'm seeing that. I mean, maybe I'm like interpreting those scenes given what you've said, but I can see what almost feels like his face, right? Like moving in, and the frame becomes overwhelmed by the presence of this character who in that film does have such a large presence.
Unbearable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things you said about so many things going on below the surface, like I kept on thinking about that with Badlands because there's such a juxtaposition between what we see and Holly's narration. So thinking about narration is certainly one of those things that Malick will continue throughout his film career. He just loves narration. But this had a fascinating role in Badlands that I see as a difference to his other films, which is films like The Thin Red Line and Tree of Life, and even The New World. The narration, you kind of get the internal world of the characters, whereas in Badlands, it almost heightens a detachment from the characters, at least in terms of Holly, right? I mean, did you get that?
I think I know what you're saying, because it feels as if they are so... I mean, Holly's very intriguing.
She's such a fascinating character.
It's really, really wild because Holly is narrating, you know, to see it through the eyes of Holly. But when you really just look... So I have a theory.
Okay.
And this is partly because when you watch Malick movies next to each other, and I'm thinking specifically, I see a lot in common between Tree of Life and Badlands, actually. Mm-hmm. Tree of Life, it's actually very upfront about this idea that some people represent nature and others represent grace, and you have this Brad Pitt, the dad character,
right,
who's clearly this force of nature, and then you have Jessica Chastain, who's grace. Mm. I see something similar actually happening with Kit and with Holly. I think in their case, just have to hang with me here.
I'm hanging. I'm here.
I think the difference between Kit and Holly is the difference between fire and water. And I see that imagery, those two images throughout Badlands. And you see it elsewhere too. I mean, good Lord, you know, Days of Heaven, the fire imagery is so intense, mm-hmm. and, you know, you can go on and on and on. But everything with Kit is on fire. Mm-hmm. He doesn't just go to Holly's house and take her out of the home. He burns the motherfucker down, whole house. He's not satisfied to just take her out of that environment. He has to literally, physically burn down everything she knows. In contrast to that, I always see Holly and the things in her life associated in some way with water. Mm. She has fish. We even see this scene, which seems like it has nothing to do with anything, where it was just this painful moment where she throws out a sick catfish into the yard. And it's like, well, what is that?
Yeah,
what does that even mean?
Yeah.
There's a scene that I feel like is the picture of their relationship, where you see Holly and she's sitting on the banks of a river. She couldn't look more comfortable. She looks like she's completely in her element. She may even have like a toe in the water. She's there. She's going with the flow. Her whole mission in life is actually to go with the flow.
She's there.
And there you see Kit, and he's stabbing the water, and he's got a gun, and he's shooting the gun into water. It just, everything about him is resistant to this idea of just flowing along. It's like he can't do it. He has to burn, mm-hmm. and she has to flow. And it just seems like if you look at each scene, and I would challenge you to do so through that perspective, Holly is water, Kit is fire. How does that work in this scene? How does that work in that scene? It actually is really, really intriguing.
Wow. Yeah, I'm going to have to do that. I mean, I can see that too at the end. And as I'm saying this, I'm fascinated by your theory because at the end, Holly chooses not to go with the flow.
Right.
And it's so apparent.
It's the moment of her life.
Oh, it's the moment. Yeah. It's so confusing to... I mean, I think as a viewer, I felt so good for her in that moment. But Kit, he didn't know what to do with it.
The look on his face is priceless, is the only way I know how to put it. Martin Sheen's performance is so beautiful in that moment because he exudes just complete bafflement at the fact that Holly has made a decision for herself.
Yeah, he can't believe it.
Boy, I had a feeling today was going to be the day. Helicopter.
Yeah.
He's not going to take us for any ride either. Come on, let's make a run for the car.
I don't want to.
Have you got a better idea?
I just don't want to go.
What?
What is wrong with you?
Hey! And then he goes off into the field for a second, and he's just what looks like convulsing.
Yeah.
Right. He's needing to. He wants to hit something or somebody.
Yeah.
And he chooses not to take any anger out on her physically. For me, I applaud that moment.
Right.
For him, it's just an affront to how they've been living for the last however long on the run. But fire and water, I love it.
You know, so what's intriguing to me, too, is the fact that this was, as I briefly mentioned earlier, based on Starkweather. Do I have that right? The Starkweather killings of the 50s?
Oh, yeah.
Which is something that I don't think anyone had made like a movie about, or I mean, maybe there had been some true crime presentation of that story or something like that. Certainly, though, no one is diving into the, you know, the poetry of a story right. like that. I mean, that just sounds insane, even to say it now here in 2017. But Malick was so intrigued by the mechanics of that story, and that's the thing that I find also so compelling about the story, was that Malick was able to take this real life situation, or at least something that was loosely based on this real life situation, and say, you know, there's something more than just a guy killing his girlfriend's dad. And then the easy thing to do is to take these two people and just turn them into a couple of demons. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of the moment in the film Natural Born Killers, where you see Mickey and Mallory Knox killing their way across the country, and then you see the TV show based on their lives.
Oh, so crazy.
And they're so Hollywooded out and all this kind of stuff, and just, you know, laughing and cackling as they're blowing cops' heads off. And then you see the real Mickey and Mallory Knox, and they're complicated, and they're focused, and there's a poetry to them, and they don't get along sometimes, and sometimes they do. But I think Malick takes it even a step further than Oliver Stone did, in the sense that he's saying, no, it's not just that they don't always get along, and it's not just that they're complicated. You're missing something if you don't see that the story of Holly and Kit is the story of us, in a certain way. And the fact that he's able to dive into a story like the Starkweather story and pull that thread out of there for a 1973 audience, I mean, to say that was this prodigious storytelling is completely undersells it. It's just an amazing insight.
I think one of the things he does with the film is he plays with like a reinterpreting of events. I mean, that's one of the things that I find so beautiful about it, but is also, it makes me relate to it, is how I can interpret events in a certain way for whatever reason. Like Holly's world is interpreted up to the point of meeting Kit, we assume, by two things. My theory is her father, but then also fantasy, in particular, maybe Hollywood fantasy.
Right.
But then later on, her world becomes interpreted by Kit. I mean, she's always referring to, well, Kit always says, she goes into that one moment where she's like, you know, Kit says that you can shoot and protect yourself even towards the law if they're coming after, like there are these rules, right, that they're living by. And I was thinking, well, I do that all the time. I mean, I reinterpret my world or my decisions all the time. And it's not necessarily always to make me the good guy. It's not that, but it's to make sense of the world. And I think that's one of the things that Holly is attempting to do throughout the story. And that Kit actually never does. Like, he doesn't ever seem to be one who's trying to make sense of things.
Yeah.
He's just living it. You know, even a friend of his, if his friend is running toward the house and he thinks, oh, maybe he's going to call the cops or he's going to go get a gun, he's going to shoot. I mean, that's Kit's response. And Holly's this character who's constantly trying to make sense of what she's gotten herself into and who Kit is. And at some points you're like, that doesn't make any sense. That's not reality. But it is. I mean, but it's her reality, right?
And that moment that you're talking about is actually the framing of one of my favorite lines and moments in the whole movie, which is, you know, you see the former friend garbage man, and you see him running back towards the house. Kit notices, he sees, okay, something's up. He pulls out his gun, shoots him through the torso, and, you know, and then leaves the guy to basically bleed out in his house. He goes back and tells Holly what happened, and Holly's response is, oh, was he upset?
How's he doing?
I got him in the stomach.
Is he upset?
He didn't say anything to me about it.
Oh, this moment is amazing. Yeah.
There's something that I can't even put my finger on what's so right and perfect and human about Holly asking that question in that moment. But when Holly asks that question, I feel like poking my head out the window and listening for the same types of questions from the world around me, because it's that level of denial and oblivion and also just an eagerness to try and make some sort of regular, normal, everyday sense out of the horror that's going on all around. And I don't know. I loved Holly in that moment.
And Kit's response to that couldn't have been more indicative of who he is, which he says...
He didn't say anything.
He didn't say anything. Like yeah, which is... Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful piece of writing. I mean, here's one of the things I saw in Badlands that continues to carry over in Malick's films is this sense of people, of living in the world... In their world, wherever that is, whether that's in characters like in Days of Heaven on a farm, whether that's in Thin Red Line in War, it's a constant question he's asking, which is how is it that we're to live here in the world, but also how is it that we do the things we do to one another? I mean, that seems like a fundamental question that he's continually exploring. And he does it in such a way where he doesn't give us trite answers for it, or maybe no answers at all. He just kind of, he lets the stories there so that we can ask the same questions that the characters are asking or struggling through, which is, how is it that we are here? How is it that we do this to each other?
Right.
Which I think is such an important question.
And somehow he's able to ask this question, particularly in Badlands, he's able to ask the question without any judgment.
Right.
I mean, you can't help it. You feel, I mean, preach to is probably too strong, but, you know, with any other movie with a similar theme or similar topics, you have to do some work to avoid some sort of value judgment on what's going on. But that's what's partly so intriguing about the Kit and Holly story is you do get a short montage toward the middle where you see film reel style, the effects of the killing that's had on the neighboring communities and everything that's going on. And in even that moment, I'm not going to go so far as to say it's surplus, but, you know, if there is anything surplus in the movie, maybe it is that, because Malick is so intentional about keeping the story with these two. It's not the story isn't the mania surrounding the killing or anything like that. It's not about the public outcry, and it's not about anything. It's about the psychology between these two characters. Mm-hmm. And that's partly why, when you see this mini brigade of, you know, armed forces personnel escorting Kit at the end after he's been captured, it's almost kind of shocking because it's like, oh, this was, I mean, we know intellectually that this is a big deal, what they've been doing, but we've never been told that it's a big deal,
right.
You know, until that moment. We're like, oh, yeah, I guess that's, yeah, sure, of course, they would send, they would send out the infantry to get this guy. But when you see it there, you're just like, oh, you know what? I mean, that makes sense. But you're so in their world that it almost catches you off guard a little bit. At least it did for me.
No, that's I felt the exact same way, where it's so not the focal point that it's confusing how much time and escalation actually passes
right
in the story that's being told on this other end. Yeah, in that reel, you're like, wait, the National Guard, right?
Yeah.
How long have they been gone? It's confusing.
Right.
In a way that's appropriate. It's not because it's bad storytelling. It's actually because Malick is focusing on the part that he wants to focus on, which is for them, and probably for Holly in particular, time passing isn't what she's concerned with. It's not important.
There's a moment, too, like in that whole section where we see, so Kit's been captured, he's got the chains on, and there's a couple things that happen. They don't seem wrong for the movie. They seem, in terms of the realism, inauthentic, but it still seems right for the movie. And the two things are, first of all, you see Kit kind of holding court with all the cops there, and he's throwing out gifts like, you know, combs and lighters and all
cigarette
this kind of stuff.
Or something. Yeah,
cigarettes. And it's clear that all the cops and all the, you know, all the armed guards, they, you know, they love him, and he's James Dean. And they make the comment, oh, this guy's just, you know, you can kiss my ass if he's not James Dean.
I love that line. That's a good line.
So perfect. But you know, you, when you take a step back, you're like, well, that's God, that can't really be how that would actually go. I mean, they've been hunting this dude for however long, but it's right for that moment, because we're still, even though he's been caught and we see the fallout and the effects, we're still in Kit and Ollie's story. And then it moves to a moment which is also, to me, not realistic, where he's like, you know, could I have a minute or two with my girl Holly?
Right.
And the cop says, sure. Yeah, go ahead. You know, say whatever you want. I, you know, you guys are clearly in love.
Can you cut me some slack with the?
Yeah, cut me some slack with the chain. And he does, and you know, then they have their little moment and all that kind of stuff. And you know, and there is the little man at the back of my brain going, come on,
right?
That's not. They're not giving a serial killer a last little moment with his best girl or something like that, but. It kind of bridges into something that I think Malick later on would do exclusively. And I had a hard time with Malick because, like you, Thin Red Line was my first Malick movie. And I didn't understand it. I just didn't understand the fuss.
Okay.
I would see other bits of Malick. So later Malick was the only thing that I had been exposed to at first. And then there was something that clicked. I think it was during a repeat viewing of Thin Red Line, because I just had read all these great reviews about how brilliant the movie is. I'm like, okay, just American Beauty style. I was like, tell me what I'm missing here,
right,
because
right.
Clearly it's something. And then something clicked when I was watching a repeat viewing of the Thin Red Line. And it was this, that Malick is not showing you things that are literally going on.
Right.
And I know that might sound obvious, but to me, it was such a revelation at this moment that I was, you know, I was watching, it may have been one of the swimming scenes or something in Thin Red Line. And I just said, oh, that's not actually happening. That's not something that the character's actually doing. That's just a representative moment of the type of character he is, or what's going on in the mind of that character, or a piece of free verse about the situation that we're talking about. And when I was able to kind of step back from it and say, I don't need to look at Malick scenes like they're plot points in a story, but rather like they're just impressions of things that are happening, then I was able to fully dive into the Tree of Life, for example, and just say, okay, no, that scene right there, it's not an actual thing that's happening to that character. That's an impression, and that's a comment on the story. And if you can let yourself get there, and I know that's not for all audiences, but if you can let yourself get there, you're going to find, in my opinion, a much more rewarding experience with Malick. And I think he's just starting to hint at that with some of these closing moments, even in Badlands.
That's absolutely true. And I think it's more true actually in the narration in Badlands than it is of the visuals.
Yeah.
So what Holly is saying, I mean, because she starts to talk about, right, when they're building the treehouse, and she starts saying, we built a whole network of tunnels under the ground. And you're like, that's not, no, you didn't.
Probably
like,
not.
Right, probably not. Like, what that's representative of, and her mind and her thinking, it's absolutely what she's believing. And I'm really glad that you brought up the idea of what he's giving us as viewers is representations of characters, or of, I think what he films, his films are like, they represent so well the feeling that someone might have in that particular circumstance or narrative.
Mm.
Tree of Life, for example, I think is so beautiful in the way that it depicts a child's memory of growing up.
Mm.
I got to a point where I was watching that movie and I'm like, I think he's filming these characters as if they're the memory of this boy.
Sure.
I mean, it's possible that Brad Pitt's character is this much of an asshole, but it's also possible that, like me, I remember so strongly those moments when my father was an asshole, and not so much the moments when he was kind and gentle and generous. Like, there's just this, he becomes this one thing.
For the next half hour, will you not speak unless you have something important to say? Sit on the front two inches of your chair. Better for your posture. I read that in the paper. Did you actually buy this from Mr. Ledbetter? Don't explain, just nod, yes or no.
Be quiet.
What did you say?
And where the mother in that story becomes also one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's profound.
Yeah.
And so what you have is a story of not necessarily how these people actually were, but you have the story of who this man or this boy remembers them to be.
Right.
And then you have that in a thin red line of, this is what war might actually feel like.
Yeah.
And this is what the memories that war might cause or the hopes that war might give somebody if they're in that. They would want to be swimming with these other native cultures in this place, and because they want connection with him. I mean, I just think it's such a beautiful thing that he's doing, and it is complicated and it is frustrating for some viewers because they're like, wait, what is happening? What isn't actually happening? How do I make meaning of this?
Yeah. So the most recent film that I saw, and maybe you didn't catch this one, was Night of Cops.
Mm-hmm.
I'll admit, it did frustrate me.
Yeah.
And this, of course, gets it a little bit into the, you know, what sorts of things did Malick cast off? What was he doing in his freshman film that he decided to leave behind later? And in watching Night of Cups, it's first of all completely beautiful, as gorgeous of vistas as, you know, in any of his movies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you fantastic. Have Emmanuel Lubezki, right? I mean, his cinematography is
beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah,
beautiful. But we're given so little in terms of anything substantial to sort of hang on to. And again, that's okay. And I found myself every 5 minutes reminding myself, okay, this isn't, I got to get away from this idea that I need to latch myself onto plot or anything like that. But it's hard because that's my language. That's our, as a culture, that's our filmmaking language, our film viewing language at the very least. And here's the cynical side of me. Night of Cups is about Christian Bale moping around L.A., doing his best to not make eye contact with everyone for 2 hours.
Right.
So,
and that's your premise.
That's your premise. And along the way, you know, he nails some beautiful women.
Right.
For me, that's it's a step backward from something like The Tree of Life, where Tree of Life felt much more filled with intention. And I probably, if Terrence Malick were here, I'm guessing he would probably say something along the line of, maybe you're overestimating the value of intention.
Right.
You know, maybe that's okay. And, you know, and maybe if he were to say that, maybe he would be right. I just know that for me, it started to get a little trite.
Yeah.
Personally, because I felt like I was seeing the same sorts of things. I'm not kidding about watch the movie, any of his most recent movies. No one likes to make eye contact with anyone else.
No, and I think that you're right about that. There's something happened, but after Tree of Life, that is a departure. I mean, it feels very different. Yeah. I think to the wonder for that film in particular, I just felt like there weren't any characters that I could connect with. Night of Cups does feel that way. I did hear Christian Bale say something about that film that's made me want to watch it through this lens. He's like, I found the character really interesting in that who's a screenwriter, that someone who's worked with words their whole life actually loses the ability to use them in a meaningful way. I'm like, oh, I didn't get that. So it makes me want to kind of rewatch it. Also in that same interview with Christian Bale, it only confirms the fact that there's little to no intention.
Yeah.
I mean, they threw out the whole idea of a script for Night of Cups. I mean, I heard stories of like Christian Bale saying, something I like to do is fall asleep on set.
I like to fall asleep on set. It's just something I sort of enjoy doing. And so he would sometimes just film me asleep or then just wake me up and say, hey, go into that other room and start talking with so-and-so. And I would walk in kind of bleary-eyed, not really knowing, and just start talking with them. And so he wants you to, he's filming. The motto's kind of film before we're ready. Like he says, you ready? No, great, go. Not having a goal at the end of each scene, so you're not sort of having that a sense of achievement at the end, where it, so it's more kind of, let's see what happens.
As a viewer, how do you make meaning of something that the filmmaker himself is, I mean, he's in the same boat you are.
Right. I heard an interview with Christopher Plummer talking about his experience with Malick. By the way, Christopher Plummer, who worked with him on The New World, is completely upfront about the fact that he thinks Terrence Malick is an asshole.
Is he really? And then
he doesn't say that word, but he says that he needs a writer. That's what he kept saying. He needs a writer.
And Terry gets terribly involved in sort of poetic shots.
Mm. And a very emotional scene that I had suddenly was background noise. I could hear myself saying it way miles in the distance while something else is going on in front of me.
Oh my God.
I had to write him a letter. I wrote Terry a letter.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I gave him a shit.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I told him, I said, you're so boring, you get into these ruts. I said, you've got to get yourself a writer, baby. Oh, my God. My career with Mr. Malick is over.
He, in some ways, though, as he was talking, he was voicing, I think, a little bit of the frustration that I think I felt with specifically with Night of Cups, because there is a part of me that said, okay, I mean, yeah, this is also interesting, and I love the fact that you're evolving the art form and you're doing your own thing. There is a side of me, though, that's like, you still did make something for us to consume, though, you know?
Right, and that's true.
Whether you want to call that a responsibility or however you want to call that, I don't know. I guess there is a certain expectation, and I even hate saying that, but Malick has started doing a thing that, and he started doing it so much that I fear that it's become trite. I call it the tease cam.
Mm-hmm.
You start to see an interaction, a connection between two characters. He pushes his camera in, and just at the moment when you're about to see the connection happen, the two characters break eye contact and he pulls his camera away. And he does this all the time, just move in, move out. And it's just, you're just like, can you hang around a little bit? I remember in Night of Cups, there was a conversation about, you know, how much Christian Bale could start to sell his scripts for and the deal. And he sort of just faded the conversation off and moved the camera away. And I'm just like, damn it, dude, I want to know.
Right.
That was actually an interesting conversation. Could you just chill out for a minute? You know, there's a moment where I'm a Dan Harmon guy. I love Dan Harmon. There's a moment with Dan Harmon in the middle of Night of Cups. And
right.
He's starting to give a talk about, like, you know, the hierarchy that goes on a film set. And then the camera just moves away and goes and starts looking at him. I'm like, no, just go back. I want to hear Dan Harmon for a minute.
Right.
Can you do that?
I know.
But he won't allow you to have that. It's almost like he doesn't want me to be satisfied with something. And it's frustrating.
It is frustrating. But I'm not confident enough to know what the disconnect is after Tree of Life. I'd say Badlands is the one movie of Malick's that he didn't discover in the editing room.
Hmm. Would you say the same is true about Days of Heaven?
I would. I would actually say that it's at least more true of Days of Heaven than
sure.
It is of Badlands.
I would agree with that.
Every other film after that is a film I'm convinced that he finds. Even if he has a script, even if he has kind of a trajectory and a plan, he doesn't know what he's going to get until he's there and he's putting things together. And I like these two things next to each other or not. But I'm not sure why it to me, personally, as a viewer, it works until To the Wonder and beyond.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do with that.
I don't know either. It's a tough one. I mean, I want to go back to Badlands for just a minute, though, because I think it's clear that his later work is probably something that, while it has a lot of aesthetic merit, certainly I think we're in agreement that there's a lot of frustration there. Mm-hmm. Badlands, though. Are there things that you see in Badlands that you think, I mean, we've talked about how he's departed, but are there things that you feel like just that didn't work as well?
So there were a couple things, and this is one of the things with Malick that I find difficult, that I'm like, is he's doing something that I'm missing?
Mm.
Is there something here that I should be getting that I'm not? Or is it just kind of misplaced? For example, there were some encounters between Kit and Holly that I found were, they at least made me really uncomfortable. Like, there's one moment when they were kissing and I wasn't sure what I was supposed to get from that moment. And you can tell she's kind of disconnected, but it was also just kind of awkward. like, was there opportunity to kind of refilm that to make it a little bit more tender? Again, was it supposed to be awkward and uncomfortable? I didn't know. So that was one of the things that I was thinking. I don't know. I just thought more could have been played out between Kit and Holly's dad. And there we got a short moment, yeah. Right, when he's painting a sign.
You know Holly? Well, she means an awful lot to me, sir.
What do you think happened to her if she stuck around with you, Kit? A guy like you.
She get along okay. If she didn't, why? She could just take off. Just take right on off. I wouldn't mind. I always tell people I deserved it.
I don't want you to hang around anymore. I don't want to see you again. Understand?
Thanks all kind, sir.
But I just thought there was so much happening that I would have liked to see more of, actually, kind of like come out between the characters, or maybe a longer conversation or more conversations. I don't know. But I just felt like, oh, that's a quick jump from, we know that Holly's trying to be kept from Kit by her father. Kit's going to go talk to her father. And then he goes to kill him. I mean, or to at least try to steal her away. So that I felt like was a pretty, it happened quickly. But again, he does really interesting things with time. That doesn't seem like it's that important. There's a lot of things going on between scenes that we see. So those were two moments for me that I thought, I don't feel like they're gelling as well. But that was just my own personal connection. Yeah. What about you?
That's a tough one for me because, honestly, I see the movie as a whole, and it feels like Malick made the movie that he wanted to make. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels... Maybe there was a few compromised moments, but to me, I guess I could get nitpicky, but for the most part, it felt like it was a pretty uncompromised product. Now, obviously, Malick had a very dramatic evolution, you know, in every film following. I think the only things that there's a couple of moments, maybe it was the studio or the distributor or the financiers or something like that. They wanted to keep it as un-hard R as possible or something like that. So there's a couple of moments like, you know, that we would sort of fade to black or something just as something, you know, salacious is about to happen or something a little more, you know, whatever. Definitely, I think that he's not going to kowtow to anyone at this point. Now, for the most part, that's part of what was so impressive to me was it felt so whole.
Mm-hmm.
There was just a feeling established from the first scene when you see him.
Right.
They're out there picking up garbage and all that. When you see these vista moments and all that, just all the beats, it felt so intentional. It felt like such a fully realized filmmaker right from the start. And I'm going to go back to Knight of Cups for a minute. I can't help but think that he had... that Badlands will always have this really, really special place in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember this, but there was a sequence in Knight of Cups that felt like it was a Badlands homage. Do you remember
which
the one?
Part?
There's a moment where Christian Bale, he's moping around different parts of, you know, places that are clearly farther out of the whole Los Angeles area.
Oh, right, okay.
And there's a moment where you can see there's like this long sort of desert kind of vista that did feel like it was a shot out of Badlands. And then from there, suddenly you see Christian Bale standing in the middle of a burned down house. And then from there, you see him standing on some train tracks. It was like a, remember this? Okay, back to the story.
Right.
It's almost hard to believe that would be intentional because that seems so on the nose for somebody like Malick to do. But the fact that those three or four shots were right next to each other in such a specific fashion, it just felt like, oh, you wanted to remind us of something,
right?
You know, in a way. And maybe it has to do with the fact that Christian Bale is supposedly a Hollywood screenwriter and stuff like that. And maybe it's taking us back to Malick's own early Hollywood inspiration days or something before he brings us back. But it just, I don't know, to me, it was actually kind of a touching little moment in the middle of a movie that I was mostly irritated by. Whatever the case, though, very little, if anything, in Badlands I felt was compromised.
Here's one thing Badlands makes me want more of. Malick's dialogue.
Oh, so good.
So good.
He wrote such great dialogue for this movie, ahead of its time.
I think so, and it's so deadpan funny in moments.
Yeah.
One of my favorite moments of dialogue was, you know, it's implied that that Holly has sex for the first time with Kit. It was so wonderful, you know, because she says, did I do it right?
Did it go the way it's supposed to?
Yeah.
Is that all there is to it?
Yeah.
Gosh, what was everybody talking about?
Don't ask me.
Well, I'm glad it's over. For a while, I was afraid I might die before it happened.
It was so good. Like, they're kind of non-emotional.
Right.
But you have everything you need.
Yeah.
In terms of what that was like and maybe how he felt about it. And it was just so good.
And all that Kit is able to muster in that moment is, well, here's a rock. Let's crush our hands so we'll never forget this.
You're right.
It's so just off the wall and yet perfect that, you know, it's just showing how how these two relate in such different and screwed up ways, I guess, quite frankly. So in the neighborhood of eight films, let's say it's around there. What do you think? Badlands, where's that? What's the rank? What would you say?
I think it's going to be, for me, it's top three. Mm. It's hard for me to actually give us, and I'm hearing our friend's voices saying, no, you need to have a number.
I know. How much grief have we gotten?
I know. And I usually have a number.
Yeah.
But honestly, with Malick, it's really difficult.
Yeah.
So I think my top three, Thin Red Line, Badlands, Tree of Life. And so it resides somewhere in there. I'm going to say top three.
Top three. Same answer for me. And my top three are also your top three. I mean, honestly, in terms of personally affecting the Tree of Life, not just a beautiful movie and a very profoundly affecting movie, Tree of Life came into my life at such a difficult moment. Not to get too personal, but I was dealing with issues that are dealt with specifically in that movie at that moment in a very, very intense way. To be able to have that sort of perspective, nature and grace at that moment in my life was, we've talked about this before, you have movies that are great, you have movies that are important to you, and then you have movies that have actually influenced the course of your life.
Right.
And I would say Tree of Life was one of those movies for me. So that's probably going to have to be number one. I'm with you, though. Thin Red Line, Badlands. In this moment, and maybe it's just because I've just been thinking about it a lot, I feel like maybe Badlands is my second favorite Malick film. I'm so impressed with it. Knowing the context of it, just the time it was made, under the circumstances it was made. We haven't really even talked about Malick's hermit reputation or, you know, but just knowing the type of artist that Malick is, the fact that he came up with Badlands, got it financed, even stepped in for a minor role at one point in the movie. He plays the architect. It's such a beautiful thing. And I know I've said this about other films. I'm just grateful for it. Of the ones that I have seen, Knight of Cups is going to be at the bottom for me. It sounds like To the Wonder and things that I've heard about Song to Song are saying it's along the same lines.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't even go so far as to say, don't see those movies. Certainly if you're a Malick completist, I'm sure you'll want to, but the magic that we're seeing with Tree of Life, with Badlands, I don't know, man, that's just not something that's going to be replicated.
And I think that's the thing about Malick for me, and we have actually a similar connection to Tree of Life. That was a movie that got me through a really difficult faith questioning doubting time of my life. Thin Red Line is one of those films that made me ask questions I hadn't really considered before. It made life less simple for me in the best way. I always point back to Malick as one of those filmmakers that's a favorite filmmaker of mine because he's had such tremendous impact on my life. And then going back to and having seen Badlands then, but then also watching it now, it's hitting me at such an important time. It's just making me wonder and consider, you know, how am I detached from my world? Am I? How am I re-narrating or reinterpreting my choices and questioning why do I do the things that I do? And I think that's the thing about Malick that he does is he introduces questions we should be asking.
Right.
He helps us through questions we might be asking. And so I am too grateful for his films.
So big question. Do we recommend the film? Does it stand on its own? resounding yes, I would say, from both of us. Most definitely. In fact, I'd go so far as to say it's an essential film.
I think it's absolutely essential, especially for that time of filmmaking. Mm. When it came out, what was going on, people pushing boundaries in film. And not that Malick wasn't. He's pushing maybe the boundaries of film in a different way.
Two fantastic performances from two great actors who are still two great actors. Right. A screenplay, cinematography, just the overall direction. Everything works about Badlands. It fires on every cylinder. You got to go see it. Well, Daniel, much as I hate to say it, I think that's going to be it for this episode, man, of The Freshman 15.
But we're back.
We're back, baby. And listen, I want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us. We do want to get back on a regular schedule of doing these episodes. Put it this way, we've got a lot of great ideas and a lot of great material coming to you in the months ahead. So sincerely, thank you for joining us.
And we'd like to hear from you. So if you want to get a hold of us, you can find us on Instagram, on Facebook. You can email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. And here's the deal. So if there's some directors you think we need to talk about, send us an email, let us know, cast your vote, and maybe we'll just talk about the one that you want us to talk about.
And once again, I'm Jeremy Bear.
And I'm Daniel Long.
We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.